When a respected climate scientist says, "I'm very worried," well, we should give a listen. This is part of a forum held on May 23, 2006 at Berkeley University. It was the China-U.S. Forum on Climate Change. And you can find the whole one-hour presentation at webcast.berkeley.edu as a video. Just look under Special Events. Our speaker here is John Hart, H-A-R-T-E, from the University of California at Berkeley.
My assignment has been to summarize the topic of the impacts of global warming. It's a tremendously huge topic. In fact, we teach many courses on that subject at Berkeley, and I'm sure at the universities you all come from. I'd like to begin with a summary of just the major categories of impact with an assessment that's based on the consensus of a huge number of my colleagues who study these issues as to the level of certainty that we can attach to this description of an impact. So I've given 3 stars, which is the highest level of certainty, to the categories of impact that are shown here. 3 stars mean near unanimity among the scientists active in the field, a high level of confidence in the predictions. The science is understood, the facts are well agreed upon, and the predictions are robust. One of these is a huge increase in the intensity, frequency, and duration of harmful summer heat waves. A second is sea level rise of at least 0.5 meter by the end of this century, and with that, the loss of some island nations in the South Pacific. The melting of glaciers and of sea ice is another impact which we're already seeing the beginning stages of, and it will accelerate. With that will go the loss of alpine and Arctic habitat. I've singled out polar bears as a particularly charismatic species, which is now a candidate for the endangered species list because of global warming. Reduced snowpack in mountainous areas of the world, and because snowmelt is a major source of irrigation water for agriculture, this means a loss of water for crops dependent on that source. And then finally in this category of very high certainty is massive coral reef dieback around the in the tropical, subtropical areas of the world due to coral bleaching. A 2-star category means that a consensus exists on the underlying science and many of the facts, but work is needed to sharpen the predictions and give us a better sense of exactly what we're going to be in store for. One of them is increased intensity and possibly frequency of hurricanes and droughts. A second is reduced crop yields because of extreme events such as storms and other kinds of weather anomalies and persistent drought. And a third is increased threat of major wildfires, both in wildland forests and also in the forests that surround human habitation around the world. And my 3rd category, which is by no means one in which we are so uncertain that we don't need to think about it, here what I would characterize the 1-star category as meaning is that there's agreement that the problem is real and of serious importance, but there are data gaps and some of the basic science still needs to be resolved. One of these issues would be a sea level rise of up to, that should be 20 feet, not 20 meters, because of Greenland and Antarctic ice melt. I call this bipolar disorder because we're losing ice at both poles, and with it will come a large rise in sea level. But we're not able today to predict just how fast that ice melt will occur and what the prognosis is, say, 100 years from now. With a 20-foot or a 7-meter rise in sea level, we're going to see a catastrophic level of damage to huge numbers of people around the world and to much coastal infrastructure. In this category goes an extinction episode of biodiversity comparable to what happened at the KT boundary 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs went extinct. With that loss of species will come catastrophic loss of ecosystem services, which we are all dependent upon. And thirdly in this category is the risk of a major spread of infectious tropical and subtropical diseases to the mid-latitudes. Now, I want to make one small point here, but I think it's important. That is that there are many problems we face, and Professor Kang summarized some of these. In Inez Fung's language, not only is the patient having a fever, which is global warming, but her forests are growing bald rapidly through deforestation. Acid indigestion is afflicting our patient, and the patient is suffering cataracts from increased ultraviolet radiation from the ozone hole. And even though the nations of the world have developed a workable solution to the problem of the stratospheric ozone hole, those chlorofluorocarbons are going to reside in the stratosphere for many decades, and so that problem still exists. Now, what this figure illustrates is that these problems don't exist in isolation. They interact with each other. I call this the sinister side of synergy. We're used to thinking of synergy as a good thing. After all, the Toyota hybrid talks about the synergy drive. So synergy is good, but there's a sinister side to it, which is that the interactions between things can add up destructively. And I call this harmful reinforcement, and I give it a plus sign when two of these categories of impact interact with each other so that the sum together is worse than the sum of the parts in isolation. In some cases, there are helpful cancellations between stresses, but in most cases, when we review all the literature on these different categories of impact, we see harmful reinforcing interactions between these. For example, deforestation increases the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, causing more global warming. But global warming increases the risk of wildfire, which is destructive to forests. In addition to these interactions, we also have to deal with feedbacks. Professor Fung introduced that topic, and just to show you the perspective that I, as an ecologist, take on this, for 20 years now, we've been looking at how climate change will affect ecosystems. Ecosystem functions, biogeochemical fluxes, such as the exchange of trace gases like carbon dioxide and methane between the biosphere and the atmosphere, and also how it will affect species composition. Who lives where on the planet? And drought stress from climate change and the influence of climate warming on the decay rates of organic matter and soil can all lead to a causal connection between global warming and these ecosystem processes. But ecosystems also affect the climate. What grows on the land surface affects energy and water exchange between the land surface and the atmosphere, and that affects the climate. Biogeochemical fluxes influence how much greenhouse gas is in the atmosphere, and that affects the climate. Just to give you one example of a feedback, if you take our best general circulation models used to project global warming, and let's say we go back in time to 15, 18,000 years ago, the last ice age was ending, the planet was warming, and the massive ice sheet that covered North America and elsewhere in the world was retreating upward, northward toward the polar region. How fast did that ice sheet retreat? Well, we know how fast it retreated because we have all kinds of data that we can use to reconstruct the rate of ice melt. Well, if we take our best models of ice melt and our models of what happened over the period post the last glacial maximum, what we discover is that if we do an obvious thing, which is to replace the ice with rock and rubble that and silt that would be in the wake of a retreating ice sheet, we find that the models underpredict the rate at which the ice sheet retreated. However, if we put spruce trees into the model, because spruce trees grew up in the wake of the retreating ice, then the ground surface is darker, there's more absorption of sunlight at the surface, and the region of the planet where the spruce trees are growing behind the retreating ice absorbs more sunlight, warms more rapidly, and that speeds up the rate of ice retreat, and lo and behold, you get the right answer for the rate of retreat if you put the spruce trees into the model. One way of thinking about this is the spruce trees weren't following the ice north, they were chasing it. And if we don't include biological effects like that in our climate models, we may get a wrong perception of what the future will look like. Another most important example of feedback is implicit in the Vostok core data. The ice core from the Antarctic gives us a record of carbon dioxide and methane and temperature over many hundreds of thousands of years. Here I've just shown 160,000 years worth of carbon dioxide and temperature data. And as you've seen earlier this morning, those data sets track each other rather nicely. Now, the CO2 release during the warming must cause more warming because we know CO2 is a greenhouse gas. And CO2 uptake during cooling periods must accelerate the cooling. So, why did the carbon dioxide get released during the warming? Unfortunately, we don't know, but we know it's coming either from the oceans or from soils or from the other parts of the land surface. And we need to know that because the effect of this carbon dioxide release during warming periods is not in our conventional climate models. Models like the type Professor Fung described are now beginning to describe this. But I was interested, along with Margaret Torn, my collaborator, in looking at how we could deduce from the Vostok data what the magnitude of that feedback effect is. And in a paper, Torn and Hart, Geophysical Research Letters, which will be published this Friday, we have published a calculation showing from the Vostok data, with no model assumptions, is direct data analysis, we can estimate what the effect of this feedback will be if it operates as it has over the last 700,000 years, if it operates over the next 100 years. And what we calculate is that if you take a climate model that, let's say, predicts a 5.8 degrees Celsius upper limit for the warming by the year 2100, ignoring that feedback. Now you put the feedback in, and instead of 5.8 degrees at the upper limit, it goes up to 7.7 degrees. At the lower limit, you don't get as big an effect, and this has to do with the mathematics of feedback. There's an asymmetry. But the interesting thing about this is that the positive feedbacks exert this asymmetric effect on warming. The upper limit expands much faster than the lower limit when you put in these missing feedbacks. It's intrinsic to these, to positive feedbacks, that it exerts this asymmetry in the range of uncertainty. So when you see a projection like the climate is going to be 3 degrees plus or minus 1 degree warmer, that upper limit may be bigger than you think and asymmetric around the mean estimate. The other reason for concern is that when we look at all the different feedbacks that exist, we find that are not included in our current models, the preponderance of them, as summarized in a recent paper by Lashoff et al. In Annual Reviews of Energy and Environment, the preponderance of these feedbacks is positive, meaning not positive in the sense that they're good for you, but positive in the sense that they will accelerate the warming. So we don't know where the carbon and the methane are coming from. We'd like to know, and we'd also like to know what other kinds of feedbacks we can expect. So I want to turn now, just very briefly, to two experimental studies that I've been involved in. One up in the Colorado Rockies, which started, the idea for this originated 20 years ago when we decided we better get some on-the-ground direct understanding of how climate warming will affect ecosystems. So up in the Colorado Rockies, we set up in the late 80s what is now a long-term warming experiment, because it's still going on, to heat experimental plots with infrared radiation mimicking a global warming future. And you can see in the upper left the effect of those heaters. It's to melt snow earlier than in the control plots. That earlier snow melt is exactly what's predicted in the general circulation models, but now we can study what it does to an ecosystem. We can look at global warming before it gets to look at us. And so here's one example of an interesting impact. Up in these plots in the alpine meadows, we have beautiful flowers. In fact, it's the sustenance of the economy of Crested Butte in summer is based on its wildflower festival, which brings many, many hundreds of tourists into the county to look at the flowers. Now, what's happened is that the flowers, in fact, It's the sustenance of the economy of Crested Butte in summer is based on its wildflower festival, which brings many, many hundreds of tourists into the county to look at the flowers. Now, what's happened is that the flowering plants, like the daisies, have literally bit the dust in the warming scenario, in the under the heaters. Their flowering success is down by threefold in the heated plots compared to the control plots. Their biomass is stunted. And instead, what was a relatively rare plant in those plots, namely sagebrush, is growing like gangbusters. It loves the heat, loves the dryness, and it's taking over the plots. One of the effects of that is a feedback that we hadn't anticipated. If you look at the reflection coefficient of the daisies and the other flowering plants and compare it to the reflectivity of the sagebrush, sagebrush is darker. It's darker because it's evolved to create a warmer climate around itself because it's more competitive when it's warmer. So the darker plants cause more warming. The plants that are disappearing were brighter. Brighter plants cool the climate locally. Darker plants warm it. And so there's a feedback where locally, not globally, locally this effect of the plant redistribution is to cause a local warming. We did a calculation. If you just look within that region of the alpine, subalpine meadows, we find that there a 20% change in the regional plant cover will have an effect on local summertime climate that's comparable to a doubling of carbon dioxide. The other feedback that we saw very dramatically in these experimental plots was that in the heated plots, the carbon dived in the first 4 or 5 years of the experiment. It reduced about 20% compared to the carbon levels in the control plots because of the warming. And it had to do with something that Professor Fung mentioned. As you warm and dry plots, the plants don't take up as much carbon as they would otherwise, and that leads to a net loss of carbon because the soils continue to decompose the carbon at the previous rate. Now, what's interesting is this effect showed up early in the experiment, and the control plots' carbon levels stayed relatively constant until the year 2000, when they began to drop. And the reason for that was that from 2000 to 2004, there was a severe drought in the western United States. And that drought caused our control plots to start looking like the heated plots did in the wetter years. And so we have an example here of nature imitating an experiment and, in a sense, validating the results from the heating. Another experiment is really the brainchild of Professor Julia Klein. And she worked with me. She was my graduate student, I'm proud to say. And together, she and I and a collaborator in China, Professor Zhao, have published an article in Ecology Letters summarizing some of the effects of an experiment that's carried out in the Tibetan Plateau. And the Plateau experiment consists also of heating plots and also doing a grazing experiment where we can exclude grazing or simulate grazing, as the case may be. And what is found and what's summarized in that article is that there was a loss of species in the heated plots over the 5 years of the experiment. So biodiversity is taking a hit from global warming in this experimental study. There was a decreased plant species diversity, decreased vegetation production, and decreased ecosystem services, because one of the things that Professor Klein did was to summarize, to measure how many of these lost species provided medicine to the local people, how many provided forage for their grazing animals, and she found significant losses of these ecosystem services provided by these plants. Also, as in Colorado, a shrub expansion. So critical pastoral resources in Tibet are vulnerable to warming. Land management grazing can partially mediate the warming effects. This is one of the surprising findings of the work. Now, how do we extend these local studies from local plots to global scale. The usual approach is to do some kind of modeling. We have to scale up this detailed sound knowledge that we acquire from experimental controlled studies in particular ecosystems, but we have to scale that up to large scales. How do we do it? Well, one very widely used approach is called the climate envelope approach. And the concept here is that we can think of each species or cluster of species as having a set of temperature and precipitation requirements. It's happy under these climate conditions, it doesn't do well under those, and then we can ask, well, what are those conditions like where the species is currently found? That's its climate envelope, the climate conditions where you now see it. And where will it go in the future? It will go to wherever those conditions will be found in the future. And we can work that out if we have believable climate models. Of course, to know what the future climate will be like, we in part need to know where the species will be, so there's a bit of a circularity here. And so we need coupled models that can solve a rather difficult problem. There are limits to the climate envelope approach. I'm not going to go into all of these, but just to mention two, that it ignores barriers to the movement of species. Basically, these models tend to assume that species can migrate or disperse to wherever they'll be happy, but because of habitat fragmentation, deforestation, and geographic barriers to the ability of plants and animals to shift their range, you can't assume that plants and animals are free to move to where the climate will make them happy. You also find that these models tend to lump all species into each species into a category, the species, or worse yet, into a cluster of species. But in fact, populations within species may respond differentially to climate change, and so we have to deal with that. I just want to say in conclusion just a couple of policy-related comments. My colleague, Professor Sokolow at Princeton, has come up with the concept of stabilization wedges. Shown here are the number of gigatons of carbon emitted per year, with 7 being the current emissions. And projecting out to the year 2050, you make some scenario, perhaps doubled emissions under a business as usual scenario. And then if we want to get down to stabilization of emissions, we have to have a flat curve rather than a rising curve. And if we want to stabilize the climate, we have to come down below today's level of emissions. And each of these wedges shown here might represent a technology that can contribute to the achievement of those stabilization goals, a technology such as energy efficiency or wind power or biomass. Now, that's one way to think about the challenge, but I want to make the point that there's also destabilization wedges that we need to worry about. The effects of feedbacks, loss of carbon sinks, and other effects are going to make the problem worse than is currently projected in these business as usual models. And the size of this destabilization wedge is really a measure of the burden, the extra burden on future generations. And which energy trajectory we choose, which population trajectory we choose, is going to affect the severity of that problem. In the interest of time, I'll skip that slide, and you can read the summary for yourself. Thank you very much.
This is part of a forum held on May 23, 2006 at Berkeley University. It was the China-U.S. Forum on Climate Change, and you can find the whole one-hour presentation at webcast.berkeley.edu as a video. Just look under Special Events. Our speaker here is John Hart, H-A-R-T-E, from the University of California at Berkeley.